Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you today?
Very well indeed. Thank you very much. Got a couple things I want to talk about. There's a story in the news, been getting some traction recently, that I want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting me a little riled up, to be honest with you.
You haven't been riled in so long, I miss it.
Well, it's not like, you know, they're polluting our oceans.
All right, it's been like 2 days, I don't really miss it.
But did you read where these taxi drivers in, I think it's in Minneapolis.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Here's the deal. There are taxi drivers in Minneapolis. 70% of the taxis to the airport that service the airport there are controlled by taxi companies with Muslim mm-hmm. taxi companies who have mostly Muslim drivers. No problem. I wouldn't have even noticed that. The problem is a number of these Muslim taxi drivers are now, according to their reading of the Quran, it's immoral to it's immoral to drink liquor.
Mm-hmm.
It's immoral to have liquor. And it's immoral to transport liquor under any circumstances, even if you're transporting someone who's transporting liquor. And so what they're doing is they're refusing to take fares of people who have liquor. So you've just come back from France. You've got a couple of bottles of wine in your luggage. You get the next taxi online. He says you have liquor in your luggage, and you say yes. He says, no, I won't take you.
Well, you know what I think then?
What?
I think that if you believe that, then you can't be a beer delivery guy.
Right.
And
you can't be
a taxi driver.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, you can't, either you are a taxi driver or you aren't a taxi driver.
Well, I also think that there's a difference between taxis that service an institution that is a public institution, mm-hmm. like an airport. If you want to have the Muslim cab service,
right.
and if you want to call them for a car, but they won't pick you up if you're carrying liquor, that's fine because you can call a different car service.
Correct.
But the taxis lined up at the airport, those are part of the public infrastructure. Those mm-hmm. are allowed to be there. That airport was built with
right.
public
and it's
permission.
Legal to we need to make a distinction. I mean, if a taxi driver doesn't want to carry you because you're carrying cocaine, no problem. It's an illegal
right.
substance. He doesn't have to transport you because you're carrying an illegal substance.
But I do believe that carrying, I mean, would a Jewish taxi driver get to say, and I know this isn't really the case, but would a Jewish taxi driver say, oh, yeah, that's a ham, can't come in, not going to, or, you know, you can't get in my taxi unless you're wearing a yarmulke or a hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's not, if you can't stand to be near me and my values, then you don't get the license, because taxi drivers need to have a permit to do it. They need to have a license. You don't get the public license to pick up people on the street you don't get to discriminate against me because your belief is that I don't follow your belief system.
But at the same time, if you want to have a store or a restaurant and not allow people to bring alcohol into it,
fine.
I don't have a big problem with it because it's a different kind of thing. There's a very distinct line there.
Well, the reason we license taxis and the reason is that there is a public utility aspect to it. You know what I mean? If you can't be a train conductor, then
mm-hmm.
okay. If you're
right,
you're,
or a bus driver,
right.
or you just can't be
because the government has an interest in allowing to making sure there are taxis at the airport, and this has become an obvious problem here because 70% of the taxis there are
mm-hmm.
operated by Muslim.
Right, a mail carrier can't say I'm not delivering your mail today because it has such and such in it.
Right, exactly. So I think, but I'm amazed at the number of people who are. A vocal but small minority of people have come out in defense of the taxi drivers. But even on the liberal and on the conservative side, most people have rightly, I think, come down asking the airport officials to and the powers that be that regulate taxis to require them to take you, regardless of what's in your package.
I think if it's not an illegal substance, they have to let you take it.
It's also, it's a matter of, I was listening to some other radio stations and to some television stations. They were saying, listen, you know, shut up and drive. I'm your boss when I'm paying you. Well, mm-hmm. No, that's not really the case. You're not their boss. You're their customer. And as a matter of public accommodation, you know, what if I'm taking the sacramental wine to mass? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. My religion says we have to have wine.
Right.
So you're offering a public accommodation. If I felt, okay, let's put it this way. If I felt that I couldn't, in good conscience, I was a member of the KKK, and I couldn't mm-hmm. serve black people, and I wouldn't
right.
make a sandwich for black people. Well, guess what? Then you can't be in a place of public accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't discriminate against your customers.
Right. Realize taxi drivers have to pick you up if you hail a taxi.
Right.
They can't discriminate. You say, oh, that guy looks ratty. I'm not going to pick him up.
That's a long-standing and for many friends, I understand. I mean, I'm a white guy in a suit. I always get picked up. But I have a lot of friends who are like, yeah, try and get picked up as a black person in New York City. It's actually gotten better recently, especially in Manhattan. But, you know, there is discrimination that goes on. And, yeah, I am sensitive to your feelings, but you know what? You've got to be sensitive to mine as well. You've got to be sensitive, not to my feelings. I don't care about you. You don't care about me. But to my right. And I have a right to carry legal things around. And if you want to operate a taxi on the public roads and pick up people on the street and have a license to do that, pick up people at the airport that you haven't specifically been called for, well, then you have to carry whatever I want you to carry.
But I agree, and the place I would separate that is if I want to own a cab company or let's say a limo company, who I call you and ask you to come and get me, and you say, well, I'll come and get you as long as you're not transporting alcohol, I don't have a problem with that at all.
Right, but there's a big difference is when I'm sitting at home calling around for limo companies, you know, the geographic area from which I can call to have a limo sent or a car sent is much larger. And I might be a person who says, I don't want to be in a car where alcohol has ever been. So you provide a service to those people. But when I've got my bags under my arm and that cab is standing on a regulated line at
the airport, and I'm forced as a patron, I'm forced to go to, if I want to catch a taxi there, I'm forced to go to that line.
Right, sure.
You can't just go at the airport and hail any cab you want.
Well, and also the same thing applies to the streets. I mean, when you're out in the street, there is a license. It's a public service to have taxis that have that emblem on the top. Mm-hmm. That emblem on the top is in New York City anyway. That's their hack license number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is the Taxi and Limousine Commission has. If a gypsy cab, which is an unauthorized cab, and you'll see them do this sometimes, they'll pull over and say, hey, you want to ride? If that cab doesn't have, it may be a limousine company taxi, but they don't have a license to pick up the general public. If, you know, on the street, there's a certain number of taxis that are out on the street. I should have access to any of those taxis if you're going to operate under that license. That's totally my view on it.
I'm with you.
I do remember one of my favorite nights. What happens with these gypsy cabs is they are illegal in New York, but sometimes somebody will take a limo into New York. And then they'll have the limo wait for them to drive them back to wherever they came from. So the limo has basically got 2 hours to kill. If he can drive around and pick up a couple of illegal fares, you know,
he can make a lot of extra cash.
I will always remember this one night I went out with our friends Jorge and Josh, and we went to one place for cocktails, and we went out to an extravagant dinner afterwards, and this huge stretch limo pulled up next to us, and as we were waiting for a cab, was like, hey, you guys want to ride? And we were like, yes. Yes, we do. And it was $20, and we pulled up in front of the restaurant in this phenomenal stretch limo, and we got out, and people were like, oh, who are these guys? We're like, we're the guys at the cabbie pickup.
We're the guys flagging down limos wherever we go.
Actually, the limo found us. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with Stephen Ranella. He was on the show once before to talk about the release of his book, The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. That book, just now out in paperback, is the chronicle of his year-long adventure preparing a three-day, 45-course feast taken from the pages of the historic cookbook Le Guide Culinaire by Escoffier. In order to accomplish this monumental feat, his adventures took him on a journey to locate a wild boar's bladder, fishing for stingrays on the Florida beaches, skinning eels, hunting mountain goats in Alaska, and flying from Montana to Michigan to retrieve a 15-pound snapping turtle that his parents found on the highway.
Steve Ranella, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man.
So paperback, man, that's great.
Yeah, it is nice. It's lighter. It's lighter and cheaper.
Now,
and when the first book came out, too, the whole fishing for stingrays on a Florida beach didn't seem like such a dangerous task.
Now,
that's true, because that was pre Steve Irwin's demise, man.
No, that's true. That's true. I had
some guy in Florida just got attacked by a mackerel.
Really?
Yeah, jumped in his boat and bit him, I guess.
A mackerel?
You know, yeah, it did. You know, but it's hard to determine, like, did it jump in his boat and bite him, or did it jump in his boat and hit him with its teeth?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? But it was billed as that it jumped in the boat and bit him, which seems...
Well, we can only hope that the animals aren't starting to fight back, because if they start
if they're fighting back, they're coming after you first, my friend.
Hey, babe, you know, bring it on. I dish it out. I can take it.
You know, you have moved since we last spoke. I mean, Love Conquers All. You've moved to Manhattan, correct?
Or yeah, a little bit, kind of. So, I'm there like about half the time now.
What brought you to New York City?
Well, I have in my book. It's a love story about me and a vegetarian.
Yeah.
That's a subplot.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly, that relationship did not last.
Okay.
So now I got me a whole brand new girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
The tummy sheets meat.
Oh, yeah. Like you would, yeah. She eats anything I cook. Which is like, I can't even express how much of an upgrade this was for me. So, you know,
You just said that on the air, by the way. You said it really loud. You said it really loud. You said it on the air on the radio.
Yep.
Planning on sending a copy of this show to the old girlfriend, aren't you?
And so, you know, I kind of split my time between Montana and Alaska and New York. She's actually in Brooklyn, so I used to think that it was the same thing, but I'm starting to slowly put it together that that's different, kind of.
Well, here, let me just read to you from an article I read in the New York Times.
Hold on. We on the East Coast, Montana and Nevada, they're the same thing, right? They're pretty close.
See, to me, that's fighting words.
Well, what prompted first of all, since you've been on our show, you've been everywhere. I've read about your book everywhere. You've achieved a large measure of fame, and I think it's all due to the fact that you appeared on the Restaurant Guys radio show. So you're welcome.
Yeah, you know, people know me as the guy from the Restaurant Guys. They're like, oh, didn't he write a book too?
Yeah, right.
Like,
the best-selling.
There are people who don't even know me that way. So
the best-selling book. The best-selling book helps. Okay, but I read in the Times, and here I'm going to read a little bit from the Times. For a big dinner party he gave in New York last week, Stephen Brunello, who's lived in this city only since August, had trouble assembling some of the stuff he needed. He just about gave up on potassium nitrate, for example, which he wanted to use in curing a black bear ham he intended to smoke in a homemade smoker. Then at the last minute, a friend of his girlfriend's prowling the drugstores found a bottle with an expiration date of 1985. The druggist let her have it for free. My question about that big dinner you had in New York is, would you lose our number? What, you couldn't invite us to the back black bear crazy dinner?
You know, I should have invited you guys.
Well.
We just hadn't talked in so long, I thought you were mad at me.
Okay, well, so...
And my question to you about that is, does potassium nitrate go bad?
That's really funny, because I'm like, here's the whole thing of this potassium nitrate deal. Like, I have always bought it everywhere. You know,
mm-hmm.
And people talk about, oh, New York's so great because you can buy anything you want. I'll tell you a number of things you can't buy in New York. You cannot buy Morton's Tender Quick.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, now someone will be like, oh, yeah, you can. You know, it's at some, you know,
tiny little store.
Some guy in some alleyway sells it with bootleg CDs or something. And I couldn't find potassium nitrate. And finally I found something that was expired. But, I mean, I don't know what can happen to it. I have no idea what can happen to it.
Well, your guests survived, didn't they? So nothing bad happened to
it. Oh, yeah, nothing bad happened. One place I called said, I have it, but you need a prescription to get it.
Really?
And I don't know what they're using it for.
Well, now...
So I've been eating a lot of it just to see what they're trying to keep from me.
Let's talk about this dinner that you put together, kind of scavenging New York. I mean, tell us about this dinner of unusual things. We're not talking about the Escoffier guide anymore. We're talking about a recent dinner you put together for some foodies.
Yeah, I had... You know, I had kind of my usual repertoire, which is, you know, a lot of big game animals from Montana, Alaska. And I had some fish I caught in Michigan. But as kind of, just to give it the local flavor, I collected myself some English sparrows. And those are the most abundant bird in the world. And they have the biggest home range of any bird in the world. So I felt like New York could maybe, and since they're completely unprotected, I felt like New York could maybe spare a couple English sparrows for me.
And then I
got myself some squirrels from the backyard. And I did the squirrels a favor by, one, removing I don't know how, a pound of rat poison out of the backyard. And I put out some food, and I put out some water, and pretty soon I don't know how many squirrels I had.
So the ones that got away really benefited.
I was going to say, do you still think the squirrels think you did it? Do you think the squirrels think you did them a favor at this point?
You know, I think so, because after I collected eight, so I could do these little ramekins with morels and squirrel, like kind of little mini pot pies. And I think that the other ones were kind of mad at me about that, but then now they've been hanging around again, and I don't have any intention of eating them anytime soon. So I feel like on the whole, you know, and I read one time that the number one cause of squirrel mortality in an urban ecosystem is vehicles.
Really?
You know, and also, I can't help but think, and New York is so loaded with rat poison, which squirrels like, you know, they're going to eat it, and people put it outside. I feel like in that way, I feel like I just can't really conceive that I've permanently impacted the squirrel population.
Well, also, I read that same study that said that the number one cause of fatalities of squirrels was vehicles, but that's before Steve Rinella moved to town. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Steve Rinella, author of The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine, about dinners he's had recently in New York. Now, for this dinner you put together in New York that was covered in the New York Times, you trapped sparrows in New York City. Now, you trapped them because you can't really go out with a shotgun and start shooting birds in Central Park. People get upset. How did you get the sparrows?
Well, there's a couple ways. There's an outfit. There's a guy named, and I talk about this quite a bit in my book, there's a guy named Floyd Vanner who used to live in Iowa. I think he just moved to Missouri. He designed sparrow traps for English sparrow traps. I mean, they'll catch any sparrow, but that's the ones you want to keep. Because he's a bluebird preservationist, and he designs traps for other bluebird preservationists, because when the sparrow was introduced here in the 1920s, it radically displaced the eastern bluebird and caused the near extinction of several cavity nesting birds. So that's why the sparrow is unprotected. So he manufactures these traps and designs them and tests them and everything. And I've hung out with him where he does all of his testing. Like, he's trapped 4,000 English sparrows in his traps, never eaten one of them.
Wow, what a waste.
So that's how I got turned on eating them, because I was hanging out with him. I said, we shouldn't just throw these things away.
That's
you know?
Right.
So anyways, I have some of his traps, and I also have some, a couple little ingenuitive type things I've made, based loosely on the childhood stick and prop type trap.
I heard that you did the childhood stick and prop type trap with a barbecue grill.
Well, I used a barbecue grill to hold up a large, probably like 5x4 minnow net that I then rigged with strings running in toward the stereo in the living room so that I could just simply pull the little string and it would release the net to get whoever I was after.
It sounds a little Tom and Jerry-esque.
Yeah, when I started feeding, it was kind of more like Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, there you go.
When I started feeding sparrows, I had 50 English sparrows there all the time. And then all of a sudden, wham, their breeding season started to approach. So the males started getting really aggressive with the females. And they all become really flighty, and the males do their courting displays. And I was thinking, I was kind of just sitting on them, right? I was like, well, you know, I'll spring
wait,
the trap.
Wait a second. Steve, we're going to have to leave it there for a moment. We'll take a quick break for the news, and we'll come back and find out about you sitting on English sparrows in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with
Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Stephen Ranella. His book is The Scavenger's Guide to O Cuisine, which has just come out in paperback. He's also been written about recently in the New York Times about his food adventures in New York City, which is a far cry from Montana, where you scavenge for some interesting things. We were talking before the news about how you set up a sparrow trap to trap English sparrows that you then cook and eat in New York. You know, I had this vision when I had read that you used a gas grill as a sort of a with a string attached to it as a sparrow trap. I thought you put like some sparrow bait inside the gas grill and just pulled the string and then trapped them in the grill. And I thought, how convenient! Then you just turn on the grill and you're done.
Yeah, it singes the feathers off.
picture of a male sparrow.
I never thought of that, but thinking about that now, you know, that could possibly work. But I think that the lid wouldn't come down fast enough, honestly,
and make too much noise.
Yeah, I think there would be like there'd be a delay. I don't know what happened.
I have a picture now, and also your friend. Now you're saying that you have a friend who traps sparrows because sparrows displace the native bluebirds, and bluebirds are native to this area, and sparrows are not. And you know he traps sparrows by the thousands. Why shouldn't we start a Stephen Ranella line of TV dinners, like sparrow TV dinner, with your picture on it, and like sparrow meat and sparrow.
I don't know why not. I'm into it.
You know, well, I have to say, you know, you're a hunter, and I want to talk about hunting and killing your own food because you write some pretty interesting stuff and I think some pretty important stuff about being connected to where your food comes from. We have a real Canada goose problem here as, you know, climate change has changed the migratory patterns of the Canada geese. And anybody who golfs knows that, or anybody who has a backyard that's a favorite spot of Canada geese knows that we have a real problem here. Yet when municipalities go to remove Canada geese and kill Canada geese, there's often an uproar. And there's almost never a move to when you take those Canada geese to kill
them
and turn them into food. And goose is delicious. It's one
of
my favorite foods. Well,
I hunt tons of geese out. I hunt geese out west in December and January when they're, you know, Canada geese when they're coming down. But, I mean, even besides climate change, the reason you have so many geese now is because of just modern agricultural practices. There are more Canada geese now than there have ever been at any given time.
And why is that?
Like I said, agriculture. I mean, corn, you know, monocultures in the Midwest, rice farming practices in the South.
Well,
they're a species that really likes people. You know what I mean? They thrive from people. They thrive from lawns and, you know, they take sanctuary and urban waterways. I don't really, you know, I like to hunt geese, but I like to hunt the more wild ones, the big migrators that come down, you know. But that's one reason. That's one thing I've found about having lived in different places. I found that there's on the East Coast, there's sort of that people tend to be more reactionary about animals and don't and tend to be less kind of big picture about wildlife issues.
Well, let me read a quote from you, and I think it's a great one. I really like it. You say, I love scavenging for my own food. I suppose it's important to clear that up right away. I think it's exciting to hunt and fish. People will happily pay good money for dead animals, and so long as the animals are killed by proxy executioners and sold in grocery stores. But many of those same people are suspicious of folks who enjoy killing their own food in the wild. And I find that to be the case. I can't for the life of me fathom why someone who's not a vegetarian would be horrified that someone would enjoy hunting and killing.
No, that's the thing that puzzles me the most. If I had someone come to me, like if someone comes to me and they're vegan or a real staunch vegetarian, and they come to me and they explain their viewpoint and that they think what I do is wrong, I can't even really argue with them. I mean, you're coming at me with a principled, consistent statement. But for someone to consume fish that are caught wild in the ocean, you know, and then to come act like you're bad for collecting your own food. And after this New York Times thing came out, I got plenty of email telling me what a barbarian I am.
Yeah, we get those too.
You know, for eating a bird that is, like I said, the most abundant bird in the world with the widest home range of any bird in the world.
That is threatening the native species.
Yeah, but then, you know, and then those people are reading an admittedly omnivorous food publication.
Right, sure.
So, you know, in the same issue, I remember in that same issue, there's 30-some references to meat, including tuna,
right. But they didn't get hate mail. You got the hate mail because you had the honesty to go and kill it yourself.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we talk about, you know, you're gonna kill Canadian geese, which are overpopulated. You're going to kill deer, which are overpopulated. You're going to kill wild animals that have lived this great life, as opposed to, you know,
domesticated
a factory-raised pig or a factory-raised chicken, or even an overfished population of some you know, Chilean sea bass. I mean, aren't you doing better things by hunting that overpopulated wild goose, or frankly, that squirrel that's in New York City or Brooklyn, whose likely end outcome is to be run over by a car?
I hate to say, like, oh, I know the right way or I know the truth and I'm doing the right thing. But I'll tell you what, when I look at what's on my plate, I understand what's on my plate and I understand where it came from and I understand the chances that I'm going to have of having it again. Mm-hmm. I try to practice as best I can a sustainable hunting ethic and a sustainable eating ethic. And I think the more you understand about what's on your own plate, the more you understand what's on the plate of others.
You know, I think it's very interesting. We had a woman on who was involved in animal rights causes just recently, and I forgot to bring up that, you know, in this like whole big picture look of things. I mean, the Dalai Lama is not a vegetarian. I mean, you know, the Dalai Lama himself, who you would think is the most spiritual, connected, and concerned with the whole life, you know, the whole balance of the world and the universe. You know, he talks about killing animals and having respect for the cycles of nature and realizing that we're a part of the cycles of nature. And I think that's why I think there's nothing wrong with killing animals for food in a humane way.
No, I think that's like the kind of the highest calling, you know, of a hunter, is to be efficient and also to be contemplative of, you know, the future of game species. Like, you know, I try to be involved in wildlife management issues. You know, I try to be an informing presence rather than someone who tries to oversimplify issues about wildlife. And that's certainly a role I take on, like, you know, as a writer. That's something I try to convey. But also, at the same time, you want to be, you know, it's an entertaining lifestyle. Like I said in my book, it's, like, fun to hunt. So I don't try to hide that and act like I don't want to hunt, but I just have to be out there in order to, you know, I just have to be out there in order to knock back the Canada goose population.
Well,
I don't really think it's true.
In the evening, the score method of hunting, I remember Mark and I did a rather humorous show on the buffalo hunt that was made legal again. And we talked about how they were going to legalize the buffalo hunt. I think it was in Montana.
Yeah, it was in Montana.
And it had a lottery. So people go out buffalo hunting. But unfortunately, there's been no buffalo hunting for 70 years, so the buffalo aren't afraid of people anymore. And, in fact, they're used to people taking pictures of them, so they're used to humans pointing machines at them and snapping pictures. So the buffalo weren't, like, running away.
But there's a lot of people who suggest that they never did run away.
Well, I mean,
even in Pleistocene time, you know what I mean? It's just not their response. But, yeah, no, you're very right. It was horrifying to the public to see this happen.
Oh, I wasn't horrified by it, but I thought the whole argument took on an element of the farce. But I want to contrast that to another. I'll quote you again. Another time, my brother Matt and I were hunting elk and heading up a mountain trail at the same time that a 500-pound grizzly and her two cubs were heading down it. The sow stood up on her back feet as easily as a human rising out of a chair. She held her arms up, paws down, like she was showing us her engagement ring. She was right there within striking distance. And I enjoyed the hell out of that, too. we've evened the score a little bit with you and the black bear. You know, that's different than...
Oh, yeah. No, I kind of like that. I like to go to places where there's a sense of danger about it, you know. And especially, like, to hunt in grizzly country. So, it's always fun to me. And also, maybe, there's a sense of danger about trapping sparrows in New York City, because you never know who's going to come up and, you know,
and find you,
have a fit and assault you.
I was wondering, what's the sparrow going to do to you?
But I have to know, what does bear ham taste like?
It's very similar in texture to pork. It's not as fatty as pork. It's leaner. The fat on a bear usually occurs outside the meat. It's not marbled.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had to, like, you know, it's like, let's say someone had never eaten a sweet potato, right? And you're like, what's a sweet potato like? You'd say, well, you know, it's like a potato.
Makes it sweeter.
When I compare a bear ham to ham, I'm just trying to pork, you know. I'm trying to just pull in the nearest comparison,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it would
but
be
it's
that.
Its own
but
thing.
It's definitely, it transcends pork, I think. But it has that texture, the stringiness. It's not. It doesn't make a great steak, but it makes great slow-cooked, braised meat, smoked meat.
Well, the next time you have a bear ham, I want an invitation.
Really?
Absolutely.
I'll have one soon. I'm going to be up in my cabin this June. I'll be hunting black bears up there. So.
When nice. We come back, we're going to talk more with Stephen Ranella. His book, The Scavenger's Guide to Old Cuisine, has just come out on paperback. You can find out more about it at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back talking about his food adventures and his local food adventures right here in New York City. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. And we're talking with Steve Ranella, author of The Scavenger's Guide to Old Cuisine.
Stephen, you know, I was reading just recently in a Times article about, you know, one of your dinners written by Charles McGrath. And one of the expressions that Charles McGrath used in this article, he used an expression, carefully prepared remains. And I think that, and hopefully he was juxtaposing that against the way most people think about their food. But to think about the wild game that way and to not think about, you know, the regular meat that we eat, I don't know. To me, it seems incongruous that they're not looked at similarly.
Do we care less about a cow because it's ugly?
Oh, yeah, you know, I don't know about that. I think that I can answer that by saying this, is that when I look at a wild animal and I see its wildness and it is part of a sort of this functioning ecosystem, that maybe I'm the first person that ever looked at it. I'm certainly the first person that ever touched it. It brings out me more of a respect for the animal, more of a respect for the food. You know, if I get a piece of game in my hand, I'm much less inclined to just throw it on a pan and fry it off like I would if someone gave me a beefsteak. So, you know, and that it inspires me to do something maybe sacred isn't the word, but to do something kind of more nice or uplifting with the meat, you know. Mm-hmm. So to have to prepare it in a more careful way.
And I don't even know if you know this, Stephen, but it is illegal to serve a wild game in a restaurant in New York or New Jersey that's caught in the United States. If I want to serve wild game in my restaurant, I have to buy Scottish wild game and have it imported to the United States.
Yeah, and that's true everywhere in the U.S., every state. But and even then, you're getting... You know, I mean, it's livestock. I mean, you know,
right.
When you buy wild game here, you buy like deer, elk, and even that Scottish stuff is privately owned, managed livestock.
Well,
you know, I mean, it's like one of the great paradoxes, and it's something I explore quite a bit in my book, is that a lot, and I don't get into the European scene, but here, a lot of the wildlife diseases that we have here, the deer and elk version of mad cow disease is chronic wasting disease. And that was introduced to wild herds through pen-raised animals.
Well, because in pen, when you have such tightly controlled and tightly concentrated pen-raised animals, diseases prosper.
Yeah, I mean, and wild game is really, I mean, wild game to me would mean that it's wild. But you know, in those cases, if you want to taste what it is, you're not really getting it. I mean, they're bred for docility.
Right.
They take elk and whack their antlers off so they don't damage their fellow stock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's just. To me, it misses the point.
So not so not so wild game.
Let me
ask you. I mean, you're an adventurous food guy. Is there anything that you would not eat that people eat somewhere in the world? I read that you went to Vietnam where they eat the dog, and you had even puppy paw soup there. Is there anything that you kind of feel ooky about, like animals that you just feel they're not food for you?
Yeah, I have a hard time with two things. I have a hard time with frog legs if I have to kill the frog.
Really?
There's something about, I used to hunt frog legs a lot for my dad when I was a kid, and now there's something about, like, I just don't like to hunt frogs. Huh. The other thing I like, I don't like to eat, and I just, like I said, I was, like you brought up, I was just in Vietnam, meals of dog.
Mm.
And I kept thinking that I could find my way into it. I could, like, transcend the cultural barrier by eating it enough. But every time I ate it, I just got more. It just bothered me more and more and
does,
more.
I mean,
because own things about dogs I've owned. You
sure.
Know?
I feel similarly. Does that make us a hypocrites that we don't want to eat dog, that we don't like to eat dog, and we'll eat other animals?
I think the thing that makes us hypocrites is when we take a practice. I mean, America is such a new country, and people in China have been eating dogs since at least the time of Confucius. And when Americans act like our food choices are right,
are superior,
and the choices of other people are barbaric or backward, you know, 60% of the world consumes bugs as some part of their diet.
Mm-hmm.
And we make a joke of that by portraying it on shows like Fear Factor, where people are gag over bugs with safety glasses on, you know. And I think that if you have a food taste, I would never tell someone to eat something that doesn't appeal to them. But I think that you have to broaden your mind and have a more global perspective that looks at what people eat, what people accept, and realize at least that your own tastes about food are greatly dictated by your culture. And you have to ask yourself how much you feel like having your tastes dictated by your culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the important thing is, I don't think it's hypocritical that you guys don't like dog, and I've never been offered it, so I don't know how.
See, I'll tell you why I think it might be hypocritical, Francis, and I'm willing to admit this, is that I think it's okay to kill other animals, and I have no problem eating other animals. It's just it's my view of my dog that makes me not want to eat dog.
But I think that's okay. I think it's okay for you not to want to eat dog because it doesn't appeal to you for whatever cultural baggage you. I mean, I may have been attacked by a cheetah when I was younger, and never not a cheetah, but Cheeto, and not ever want Cheetos. The problem is, if I pass judgment on someone else who does, like you said on Fear Factor, where we hold other cultural foods up as disgusting or gross, and we don't realize that other people
uncivilized.
Or uncivilized.
I think that was the point.
Are we all in agreement on that?
No, I think you are. And I don't know. I wanted to like dog. I wanted to like it just because I wanted to. I don't know why I wanted it. Like, I wanted to like it because I wanted to think that my taste buds could transcend
your mind.
Yeah, could transcend, you know,
your cultural predisposition.
Yeah.
But I guess that it's been, I've had more intimate contact with dogs than I have other animals, and I didn't grow up viewing them in that way.
And I think,
you know, like, I grow up, when I see an elk, it makes me feel kind of hungry. When I see a dog, it's just like the food thing doesn't jump out at me. My brothers mm-hmm. each raise chickens, and I look at their chickens and I always think that's a chicken. It's food, and you know, and mm-hmm. it's not a big jump for me. But the dog thing was an enormous leap.
Steve, you know, Steve, that line that you just said about when I see an elk, I get hungry, that's going on the Restaurant Guys promo commercials from now on. Anyway, we have to leave it there. We have to go. Thanks for coming to talk with us, Stephen Rinella. The book is The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. You can find out more about it and pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Stage lefty, Kevin Lombardi.
You know, Francis, we were talking to Stephen Rinella, and we were talking about Brooklyn Squirrel. And actually, Stephen could get in trouble for doing what he did because it's illegal to trap squirrels in Brooklyn. He could be in some serious trouble for catching those squirrels and eating them.
How do you know that, and why is it illegal to trap squirrels in Brooklyn?
I don't know how I know that, but I know it. It's illegal to catch a squirrel and eat it.
Really?
Yeah. Craziness, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it is. But I always wonder.
My question is, were people doing that on a large scale and they had to pass a law to stop them? I mean, how does a law like that begin?
I don't know, but it is illegal to trap and kill squirrels. You have to have them taken away by the SPCA or whoever. It's, I don't know, some kind of animal cruelty. But my real question to you is, do you think Brooklyn squirrel tastes different than Montana squirrel?
I'm sure of it.
You know, Brooklyn squirrel gets to have, like, Big Mac remains, and you know, gets to eat from Wendy's every once in a while.
Where your family comes from in Brooklyn, they get like pasta and meatballs.
No, they don't. We don't. We eat them all.
Oh,
yeah,
that's true.
None of them get. None of those go out to the garbage.
That's true.
You kidding?
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know that I'm eating the urban squirrel.
The squirrel by my house.
Yeah.
Okay. Right after at the end of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
If I catch squirrel at my house, it's definitely gonna be at the end of the summer because they're gonna be big. Fat tomato-eating squirrels
from
is
your
what
garden.
They're going to be. So that will be. If I don't get to eat the tomatoes, at least I'll get to eat the squirrel that got to eat the tomatoes.
I've not seen a tomato from your garden in years. You're still growing them, right? You're just not harvesting them.
I grow them every year.
Growing them for the squirrels. That's a beautiful service you've done for our animals, Mark. That's really terrific. I hope you've enjoyed this hour talking to the Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Chuck.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.